Transportation and Regional Governance Policy Committee is called to order. And we have a couple folks here that could do the minutes, but Representative Mason, have you had a chance to check out the minutes? Would you like to make a motion?
Move approval.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Mason moves approval of the minutes of March 21st, 2018. And any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. All right. And we're going to jump to House File 2999 because we see Representative Haley in the room. So we'll take that one up first. Representative Haley, welcome.
Thank you.
And I'll move your bill, Representative, House File 2999, and that will be going to Transportation Finance. So.
Okay.
So welcome, and please go ahead and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for allowing me to present House Bill 2999. I will be brief. This is a request to designate a portion of U.S. Highway 61 between Lake City and Wabasha in memorial to Minnesota State Trooper Dale Lorick. This was brought to me by a constituent, Steve Lorick, who is his son. I'll just briefly tell you about Dale. It's a good all-American Midwestern success story of just an honorable man. He served as a corporal in the U.S. Army and then was a combat engineer during the Korean conflict. He graduated from State Patrol, was posted in Wabasha, and assumed patrol duty along the highway stretching from Hastings to Winona along the Mississippi River. And he remained there for 33 years throughout his State Patrol career. Just an interesting man. He married a widow that had three children, and then they had two more. He raised those five kids and sent them all to college. And his kids as well have served in our military and in various nonprofit and government offices. So in the words of his son, his father presents a worthy model for the state of Minnesota Patrol, for Minnesota and the nation. And according to, using a quote from the Navy and the Marine Corps, he always recognized and taught his kids that there are things bigger than self. And I would be honored to have a portion of the highway where I live named after him. And that completes my testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have others that wish to speak to the bill?
Not today.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, then I'll go ahead and renew my motion to re-refer House File 2999 to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Haley. I'm sorry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. All right. We have Representative Pearson is here, and House File 3625. Can take that up now. Welcome, Representative Pearson. I'll make a motion that House File 3625 come before the committee and be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Welcome, and please tell us about your bill.
Hi. Good afternoon. And as legislators, we frequently hear about the important role of mental health services for children in our communities. This bill brings this committee a key barrier to mental health, and that is much lesser known, and that's the basic challenge of accessing services due to the lack of reliably safe transportation for our children and youth. As you'll hear from our testifier, when kids receive mental health services, their lives improved markedly in the short term and in the long term. Due to the commitment of our provider community to delivering services to kids in need and their long struggles with trying to fix a transportation system that was not designed for kids, they are now asking for our help in securing a deeper level study to design a transportation service with the unique needs of our kids at the center of the design. To the bill, House File 3625 is requesting the Department of Transportation collaborate with other experts, state agencies, and develop a report on how transportation design for kids in the need of mental health services can ensure safety and quality in transportation, leverage Medicaid and managed care to finance this medically necessary transportation, include basic demographics and understanding of children to receive these services, outline current spending on these populations through the existing non-emergency medical transportation services. Both services provided are and where needs are currently not being met. This is a unique request, and it comes to our committee, comes to this committee out of the hope that we can design a system that can do better for our kids. I'd like to introduce Stephanie Combe to speak more to the circumstances that brought this bill to us today.
Welcome, Ms. Combe. Please introduce yourself and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Combe. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker and the senior director of mental health services at St. David's Center. I'm speaking as the board president of Aspire Minnesota, an association of providers who provide children's mental health services and mental health, child welfare, juvenile justice, and homeless youth services statewide. I'm grateful to the members of this committee for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 3625. For over 20 years, I have been a leader of mental health services for children in the nonprofit sector. In that time, I've seen many changes in the array of services available and an increase in the awareness of mental health issues in children and adults in our state. Research and professional training on areas such as brain development, the impact of adverse childhood experiences, trauma, and autism have allowed us to implement more effective treatments. One of those treatments is day treatment, including early childhood day treatment for preschool age through day treatment for young people in high school. Day treatment provides an effective intervention for children at risk of hospitalization and residential treatment. We provide intensive, typically 5 days a week, coordinated, community-based mental health intervention where each child works on their individual treatment plan within an environment of peers and trained mental health providers who are able to intervene in the challenging thinking and behavior patterns, often as they are occurring, in an environment that is supportive. Additionally, family involvement in services is also an integral part of our treatments. The goal of day treatment is to help the young person integrate their ability to recognize their emotional symptoms and help have healthy and safe ways to manage the symptoms. Once a young person has achieved this goal, we work closely to help them move to a less intensive setting, such as outpatient services, and manage in a more typical environment. At St. David's Center, our preschool day treatment programs focus heavily on helping the child be able to move into kindergarten with the socio-emotional readiness and self-regulation they need to succeed. The challenge in being able to provide this crucial service to children in our communities is that they need to be able to get to our day treatment services. Non-emergency medical transportation services are critical to assure kids can receive day treatment. Sometimes kids we serve do receive safe, quality transportation, and for that we're grateful. Far too often, the transportation for children and youth needing day treatment services does not reach basic safety and quality standards. As chair of our day treatment committee, I can report that as providers, we have worked on transportation challenges and sought to develop means to assure safety and quality in our current system. I'm here today because after much work on these issues, we have concluded that our current system is simply not designed for children and thus not capable of addressing the unique safety needs of our kids. We are asking this committee to require a study of this challenge to deliver new design ideas for transportation that can meet the unique needs of children needing mental health services. As you can see from the handout that includes data collected from members in the most recent months, regular transportation challenges relate to safety, such as a lack of car seats for small children, timing for drop-off and pickup that jeopardizes basic safety due to a lack of supervision of the child or youth, lack of timely communication when changes to a route take place, leaving caregivers to wonder where their children might be, placing children too close to one another that allows children to aggressively fight or engage in inappropriate behavior, the quality issues, drivers are not trained in the unique needs of the kids, and can inadvertently create an environment that causes distress through their conversation, their inattention, music, and other factors. Drivers can also escalate situations by yelling, threatening, or through other responses that enhance fear or aggression for our children. Current systems do not afford for the unique circumstances of kids, requiring multiple contact people to receive communication due to multiple care providers in a child's life, requiring scheduling for rides that is burdensome and expects an adult's ability to arrange for timely transportation. A lack of clear response and chain of command when things go wrong and a child is abandoned without a ride or not located due to route changes. System design discourages affording a consistent driver for a child, a simple example of what one step that could resolve many of these challenges. When quality transportation providers are identified, they often do not have the capacity to add more rides for our kids. As agencies, we are committed to providing these critical mental health services for the children in our state. However, as I said, we cannot do so if the children don't arrive safely and consistently. This bill is before you because we are also certain that transportation can be designed to meet the unique needs of the wonderful children and youth we serve. Our kids work hard on their mental health knowing that they can get better. Similarly, we invite you to join us in working on a transportation that designed that incorporates our kids' unique needs from quality to quality and safety as we know we can find a better way to do it for them. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Crombie, do you the age range, are we talking all the way up to 17 or would there, I mean, how young are you talking?
So typically about 3 to 4 is our youngest, so especially for children on the autism spectrum. For those of you who have been hearing about autism, the earlier we can intervene with the most intensive services, the better. And so 3, and then typically up to age 17. Not all in the same program. Different programs provide different services. So
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Rundbeck. And Ms. Combe?
Combe, yeah.
Yes. St. David's in Minnetonka, correct? Wonderful. Great program. Thank you for the work you do. I do know that you transport, or the school districts transport, a lot of your students from your program into, let's say, ECSE at Harley, where I used to work. Are you talking about that transportation in particular that's provided by school districts, or are you talking about alternative transportation?
We're talking about...
Ms. Combe?
Sorry.
Can you address the chair, then?
Yeah.
Goes easier. Thank you.
We are typically talking about... transportation that is not provided by school districts. It is provided through the non-emergency medical transportation.
Okay. All right. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. The school districts do transport students of those same ages. Would you need special legislation above and beyond the criteria for this school? The transportation provided by the school district.
Ms. Combe.
Thank you. The school districts, I want to be careful on how I say this, it's inconsistent as to when and they will or won't provide transportation to our day treatment services.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay. And Ms. Combe, I'm interested, wouldn't have thought that the Department of Transportation would be brought into a discussion like this. So that's, you know, interesting. And how much do we know about the current system? I mean, you're gathering data from all over the state then, or are there a number of organizations involved? Just what is the support the group look like that's pushing for this?
Okay. So there depends on who you're talking to. In some of our rural areas, there are not medical transportation providers. So that is a little bit different issue. But in the metro area, we have a number of different medical transportation providers, and that service is provided through medical assistance is the payer source for that, to my understanding.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, this is really interesting to me, actually. So your age range goes as young as 3 and 4-year-olds up to 17. Do you have an idea of the numbers when it comes to how many children are not being served adequately right now? And how many young children would be unaccompanied?
Ms. Combe.
I can't give you that exact data today, but we could certainly get.
Well, I'm sorry if I may, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. And I think it gets to the couple of the points that have been brought up already. And directly, you know, the Department of Transportation being pulled into this isn't something that it sounds like they're particularly thrilled with either. But what's important to be aware of that when these programs have been established, we're really talking about the non-emergency medical transportation as an umbrella, and here specifically the unique characteristics of transporting children. And because we don't have the answers to some of those questions is exactly why we're here, and that's exactly why this study is being requested.
Sure. Representative New, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with the non-emergency medical transport, are they already providing a significant portion of this transport, or is it primarily school districts right now, or is it a combination? Ms. Combe?
There is a significant amount of medical transportation being provided currently.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pearson, have you spoken to the non-emergency medical transportation committee? And if so, are they, what is their response to your legislation?
Representative Pearson?
That committee, I have not spoken to on this specific issue, but the groups that are behind this bill are looking towards, again, getting a full evaluation and study and understanding of the needs and the shortcomings of the current program as it pertains to children.
Representative
Madam Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Well, thank you. Just to follow up. Representative, if you would like any assistance, that particular non-emergency medical transportation committee is something I'm well aware of. I started with an legislation 6-7 years ago with that. So if you would like any assistance with that in communication, I'd be very happy to lend a hand.
Thank you.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for the testifier, and you may have already mentioned it, so forgive me. But with regard to the children that are unaccompanied and Representative Pearson just mentioned the non-medical transportation in general as an umbrella, are there other instances of non-medical transportation for children, just a regular doctor's appointment, et cetera, where we're finding them unaccompanied, and why study just the mental illness piece in particular?
Ms. Combe.
I can't speak to the issue of going to medical appointments just because that's not an area that I work in. What makes this a little bit unique is that in a typical doctor's appointment, you know, a parent would accompany a child, but because of the 5-day-a-week intensive nature of this, it becomes prohibitive for families to access the service if the parents were required to accompany their child and be there each time.
All right, any other questions? I think we have a testifier from the department. Welcome, Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Radin with MnDOT Government Affairs, and we certainly have no objections to the study. Our concern, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, is whether we're the correct agency to lead the study. There's some requirements in the bill about vulnerabilities due to health care needs and age, how to leverage Medicaid funds, how to engage and leverage managed care organizations as payers, the benefits of meeting mental health needs of children and youth. So some of these things sound like they would be more appropriate for the Department of Human Services, and you know, the bill does direct us to coordinate with the Department of Human Services, but our feeling is that perhaps they would be better to be the lead agency on the study.
Any comment, Representative Pearson?
I'm looking forward to working with all of the departments to try to move forward with a solution to that issue. You know, specifically, we did talk about the current programs of the non-emergency medical transportation, and again, MnDOT's role in that, when that program was set up, was to make sure that that they had the operating authority, the safety of the vehicles, the background checks, and the training of those individuals. So, you know, there is certainly some pass between who has oversight over specific issues that we're dealing with, and I'm willing to work with all the departments to make sure we get a proper solution.
Thank you. Does anyone in the audience wish to speak for or against the bill? Okay, seeing no further discussion, then I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3625 to Transportation Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill prevails. Thank you, Representative. Okay. All right, we're going to move up here to House File 3980, Representative Dean's bill. Welcome, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I'll move your bill, House File 3980, and that will go to Transportation Finance.
Thank you,
see we have an amendment. Is it the A1? Okay. The A1 amendment, is that the author's amendment?
That is.
All right. I'll go ahead and move the A1 amendment. Do you want to give us some background on it then?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This particular amendment clarifies the funding source for the program that is within the amendment. If you look on this, it's on 2.29. It looks at the rail bank accounts appropriation. The language was requested to change that funding mechanism, and that's what the amendment does. I can go ahead and explain the bill if we want to put that on.
Well, Representative, maybe we should go ahead, as it's the author's amendment. We'll move that amendment. All those in favor signify saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Right. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And Madam Chair, you are very familiar with this because this is a came about as a result of the City of Hugo, where both the Chair and I represent, had a very specific local issue with a short line railroad that needed to serve two employers in that area that have 500 employees, and it's a little tiny 5-mile section of track that needed to be improved, and there was really no way, no good way to pay for that. The short lines do not own the land. They can't borrow against it. They can't bond it, so that they are sort of up they're at the end of the rail when they are trying to improve that. And what I found in looking around the state is that this is by no means specific to our area. And what we had to do was to get a bonding appropriation to try to get that improved so that they could maintain access. But in fact, in greater Minnesota, it's far more common than not to have sections of rail that are used connecting a grain elevator or a very small town to the rest of the world, and it might be very akin to a vital organ that is the last vital organ that keeps a small town connected to the rest of the state and the country for commerce. And so it's very, very important. Representative Schumacher represents an area in Rock County that had a short line that the track was in such poor condition that the cars could only go 5 miles an hour to access that area. And so it's an economic development issue that we're going to be facing around the state. So that's what this attempts to do, is to put us in line with other states similar to Iowa and Wisconsin and others that have funds that are available that we can use the DOT to say what's a good project and what's the order we should do these in, and to try to keep them connected. So that's what the bill does, and I do have two testifiers, Dan Weber, the Assistant County Administrator for Sherburne County, and Jason Colotta, Director of Public Relations for Progressive Railway.
Welcome, gentlemen. We have a question from Representative Petersburg. Do you want to wait? Okay.
Sure.
So welcome, sir, and please give us your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. My name is Dan Weber. I'm the Assistant County Administrator in Sherburne County. And today I'm speaking on behalf of Sherburne County in support of House File 3980. The creation of Minnesota Freight Rail Economic Development Program was one of the 8 2018 legislative priorities established by the Sherburne County Board back in December. In addition, the program was also a statewide legislative priority of both EDEM, which is the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, and MAPSED, which is the Minnesota Association of Professional County Economic Developers. The cost to develop an industrial lot, much less an industrial rail park with adequate rail infrastructure, are prohibitive and hinder the opportunities for local growth in both Becker and Big Lake within Sherburne County and similar communities statewide. Typical costs for a rail project include approximately $230 per linear foot of track and a minimum of $250,000 for the installation of a switch. Costs to make a lot truly shovel-ready can rise to over seven figures very quickly. We believe this bill could provide partial funding for such purposes as new siding, spur, and trackage construction, track improvements and upgrading of existing track, repair and replacement of bridges, culverts, and other critical supporting infrastructure, and perhaps rail feasibility and impact studies, which can quickly reach six figures as well. We are convinced that this bill will create a competitive process that would assist statewide communities like Sherburne County in providing the necessary rail infrastructure improvements to make these rail projects more attractive and cost-effective to nationwide developers. Thank you for your time today, and we appreciate your consideration of House File 3890.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. All right, let me go ahead, sir, then, and take your other testimony.
So, thank you, Chair Runbeck and members. I'm Jason Collada, Director of Public Affairs for Progressive Rail, which is a short line rail holding company based in Lakeville, so represent Kosnick's territory. And Lakeville Brewing is a good place to meet. But anyway, here today to talk about this legislation that's been offered by Representative Dean. We certainly appreciate it. We operate five short line railroad segments in the state of Minnesota. Four of those are leased. The fifth, we just own the track and not the land. On each of these, we have a number of different needs that are difficult for our company to justify the investment in. All of these lines have been spun off from a larger Class 1 railroad, and it's nothing against the Class 1. They have a different operating model. They move the long distances. We deal with a lot of the smaller customers in the shorter areas in the local delivery, and that's where we specialize at. That's where we really make our business model work, and we've done that very successfully. The trouble is a lot of these challenges are just very great for us to overcome. In some instances, we have very, I hesitate to call it light rail, but it's 80-pound rail in a yard segment, and that simply cannot bear a lot of the weight of the modern cars that we seek to operate. 115 pounds is the weight that we prefer. In other cases, we have bridges. For example, over 35W, we have a bridge that runs in Bloomington that needs upgrade and repair, and it becomes difficult for us to do it because we don't have the largest budgets. We have about $1.5 million that are allocated for maintenance projects in Minnesota for this 2018 year. And the capital needs, as I've laid out in this memo being handed out, are over $17 million in Minnesota. And so we certainly appreciate Representative Dean offering this legislation. I know others in the state have made this an issue and understand its value, and we appreciate your time and consideration of this request.
Thank you, Mr. Collada. I wonder if I could ask, how did we get to this point? I mean, it seems like all of a sudden, you know, there's a big interest and there's a big need, and what brought that on just now?
It's actually not all of a sudden. I know Representative Dean has dealt with this issue probably a couple sessions now, if I'm not mistaken. But
what's the recent history here, Mr.
Overall freight volume is expected to double between now and 2036, according to the U.S., the federal government's General Accounting Office. And the concern is we're looking at electronic logging devices now being required for trucking. We have difficulty getting more young people to enter the trucking industry. Average age pushes about 55, and so the challenge of doing over-the-road trucking is tremendous. Freight rail provides a great alternative, but if you lose your freight rail, you lose your opportunity to take advantage of that. And so I think right now you're seeing that confluence of increasing demand, the inability, the capacity of the market to handle it, and we're able to help with a solution, but not if we're not around.
Okay. Other questions, Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers or to Representative Dean. We've had quite a few bills come forward to us in regards to repairs of bridges and other things in regards to short line rails. And the question we still have a struggle with is exactly who owns a bridge, who owns the track, and why is it a state issue for repairing the infrastructure that has generated revenue and so forth, as compared to any other industry that also generates revenue as well. And so if you could help us, just kind of help us understand, do more short lines own their own track? Do they lease from somebody else? What is the lessee's responsibility, and what is lessor's responsibility in maintaining those tracks?
Sure. Excellent.
Mr. Collada.
Yes, sorry, Chair. So most short lines are, in fact, leased from a larger Class 1 railroad typically. And normally they have, we take on the obligation then to maintain the line, to keep it operational. If we can't meet that, we end up having to pull a segment out of service, and we hate to do that because that means less business and we're not able to serve the folks that we hope to serve. So historically, we have not really relied much on public funding, with some exceptions, but typically the short line industry is just about 100% privately financed. I know Progressive Rail doesn't have a history of actually going to any public bodies in Minnesota, so this is kind of our first run at it
in the Minnesota legislature is actually this year. But the challenge is, you know, there's a substantial amount of money that's put into the highway system. There's always interest by some folks to raise truck limits, and that's just going to wear out the highway system quicker. Those highway bridges cannot handle, they're not built, they're built for 80,000-pound trucks, not 98,000-pound trucks. And so there's other costs and challenges that the legislature and the state will bear if there's not other solutions, multimodal approach, and freight rail is another mode.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that this just question to me is understanding all of those parameters, has your a railroad company and others that are in short line, have they thought about how they're going to try to increase their maintenance costs into the future budgets? Because obviously, it's part of the reason why you're being effective is that you have freight out there being able to move, and yet you also need to have a plan, a business model that will actually help support that infrastructure and move it forward with that. So I'm just curious what your plans are, what you put into the future, and about how you're going to maintain. If this was to occur, my guess is this isn't going to be enough either. Then what? So.
Well, when we succeed when we are able to build the business and move more freight. So, for example, between Northfield and Randolph, we were able to upgrade the rail. We got a significant new grain shipper that located on our line in Randolph, and we were able to increase that. I mentioned the weight of the rail before, to bear these now 110-car shuttle trains. And right now in the season, we get about one a week to come through, and that really helps pay for the cost of the infrastructure. But if you go from east of Randolph to Cannon Falls, we'd certainly like to develop more business there, but we don't have the volume to generate the revenue to us to justify putting in. It's about $4 million to do that project. So our argument is, if the state can provide some assistance with us maintaining and really strengthening some of our infrastructure, we know we're going to be able to be competitive on costs with other freight and be able to add more volume on our system.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair. And I know this involves issues with creating a FRED program and implications for the Mercy program. I'm wondering if MnDOT is scheduled to testify, has any perspectives. I'd like to hear MnDOT's views of this.
All right. Could we get somebody from MnDOT to talk to us about this? Welcome, sir. Please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gardner. I'm Director of the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations at MnDOT, which includes all of our freight rail activities and programs. We are very supportive of the intent of this legislation in terms of using rail to retain jobs, to grow jobs. We've been working with DEEB and other economic development agencies and the railroads themselves to try to look at a variety of strategies to advance freight rail economic development, in particular investing in infrastructure, which is very, very important, particularly for the short line industry. As you've heard, there's a number of needs out there. These capital projects are high in cost, very difficult for relatively small companies to undertake those projects and finance 100% of the project. So what we look for are projects that produce public benefits, that are taking trucks off the road, that are generate supporting those shippers, those companies that are trying to move their goods and products to market and to retain their jobs, to grow their jobs. Our concern, if you will, is that we have an existing program. It's called the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program. It's been around about 30 years. It's really helped to stabilize the short line industry, and we have a variety of financing mechanisms. Primarily, it has been loan-based, so those it's been relatively self-sustaining, a revolving loan fund that we've provided to the short line industry. This past year, the legislature actually changed the program significantly to, for the first time, allow grants, specifically for economic development projects. And we are in the process of implementing those provisions with very similar eligibility criteria and other items that are identified in this legislation. So we're a little concerned about sort of setting up two programs that are quite similar with similar goals that in some instances would compete with each other, and moving money from one program to another and DOT administering both of those programs. So we would be very interested in discussions on how we could continue to modify the existing program to incorporate the intent of this legislation, and of course the topic of resources, the investment in the program ultimately determines its success, the money that we have available to invest in these projects, which we would do on a competitive basis. We'd look for cost sharing and so forth.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Gardner, is it your view then that this particular project is, you know, would meet the criteria and is appropriately done through the existing Mercy program?
Madam Chair,
Representative, I do believe that we continue to work with the railroads and with DEED and others to set the specific criteria for our first solicitation of these projects, which we expect this summer. And yes, we do think the existing program could accommodate the intent of this legislation.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick, to the testifier?
To the previous testifier,
okay.
Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. I think we've got your testimony. Appreciate your presence. Representative Kosnick.
Madam Chair and Mr. Kalata, I just wanted to clarify that how are exempt rails, are they eligible for any of these repair costs under this grant program, or are they nothing to do with it?
Well, Mr. Kalata.
Take a step back. So in this last bonding bill, the legislature approved $1 million as a one-time program, essentially a grant for the Mercy program, which has been a loan program. So we have a balance in a continuing revolving loan program, and we have a one-time $1 million bonding bill authorization for grants. So what Representative Dean has offered is essentially a permanent program beyond that. So I just want to kind of have those facts out there. We would have to make the case, and all the criteria of what this grant program looks like haven't been all spelled out by MnDOT yet, but we've had a number of conversations with the department. We're looking to see that. My presumption is that, yes, accepted track. So this is track on which there's speed restrictions because of its age, doesn't have enough ties or ballast rock supporting it. So the speed of the trains is limited. Our assumption is that those types of programs would qualify, but these are very expensive operations, and $1 million gets chewed up pretty quick.
Follow up?
Yeah, Madam Chair. So there's only $1 million for these exempt rails, and basically I'm curious about the exempt rails in Lakeville. Would they qualify under this program or not?
Mr. Kalata.
So the track in Lakeville is larger and in pretty good shape. I know just this last fall we did a tie project through town. We're anticipating a surge of traffic in the spring, and we're going to have to handle a bunch of loaded cars, cement cars that are going to end up storing up on the tracks in Lakeville for a few days before they'll be pulled back down and emptied, largely to feed the MnDOT construction season coming up. So Lakeville is in better shape than a number of the other track that we operate.
Representative Pasnik?
I'm good for now. Thanks.
All right. Representative Joaquin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kalata, I guess I'm not familiar enough with your contracts with the Black River Rail companies when you do lease these rails. And you said before that when you do those contracts, then you become responsible for the maintenance, which seems like the bigger companies should be taking care of their infrastructure to begin with. So is there ever been any movement or room to renegotiate on who has to maintain? Because it seems like they're just passing the buck on to you.
Mr. Kalata.
Typically not. So for the short line, it's the opportunity to serve that territory and those customers or potential customers who could locate on the branch on the short line. For the Class 1 railroad, usually it doesn't work well for them to serve that territory. They can't get a crew there, especially if there's a customer that needs multiple switches in a day. So let's say they have, you know, three plastic pallet cars they need to unload and bring another three in the same day to meet the shift. We can do that because we're local and our crews aren't stretched as thin. So it's just a different model, and we have to make it work, and unfortunately we have that obligation.
So, Joaquin, follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Klotek, I can understand that it's just hard for me to compare those to moving freight on rail, on roads and bridges in our transportation system, because those other people can access and drive on. People can't take their personal car and drive on the railroad. So I think there is a little unique difference there. And I do worry about, great that we had the money put in the bonding bill to make it loans, make it grants instead of loans, and I understand how that money could get chewed up very fast, but MnDOT's in the process of putting all that together right now to start something on top of it that might be competing. I'm just hoping that maybe this is just to the author, that maybe you can work with MnDOT and figure out a way to work within the existing program they're just fleshing out right now.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more for Representative Dean, and thinking about this bill more holistically and looking at it, what is the future for this corridor as it relates to the community and the rail line, and figuring out, bringing all the stakeholders together and figuring out, okay, if these upgrades are going to be made, what is the impact to the community? What are there any issues that will affect the community? Is there plans for this corridor after it wasn't going to function anymore, that for uses for community, whether it's economic development, it's trails, things like that? So I just wanted to figure out how we can make this bill so that all the stakeholders are brought together, so when the plan moving forward to upgrade the railroad, the best plan is in place that impacts all of the community, not just the rail and the businesses along that line.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative. The intent is simply to try to improve the access with the rails that need the most help, particularly short line. But part of that is bringing the communities together around what the long-term plans are, mm-hmm. and working together with MnDOT, and I think that that's what they're very good at. And we want to make sure that things move a lot faster than they have been. The needs are pretty surprisingly large when you look around the state, particularly in greater Minnesota, at access for agriculture and also for small and medium-sized towns in Minnesota. So we want to make sure that this moves faster rather than slower. So that's why I want to try to push it down the tracks a little faster.
We can just follow up.
Mr. Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up with that. The Mercy Fund account is something I actually have a bill in for this year, so I'm interested in keeping that whole. And then also just to make sure, I like what you said about bringing the community together. I'm not sure exactly how you said that, but there, like through the corridor, through, I don't know if you represent that district or not, but you helped with that bill last year through White Bear Lake. There's plans to do Bruce Vento extension up there, and that would have been an opportune time to figure out, okay, how can we do a win-win and meet these needs for this community all at the same time, so there's more public good that comes out of it, or there's additional public good that comes out of it that would happen that's not happening right now. Would you entertain that kind of trying to work on that, Representative Dean?
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair and Representative Bernardi, I would love to and be happy to chat with you about the bill and get any input that you might have.
Thank you.
Are there individuals in the audience that wish to testify for or against the bill? Okay, any other discussion from the committee? Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion to refer House File as amended, 3980 as amended, to Transportation Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative. And next up, we have House File from 4103. Representative Daniels. Yes, pinch hitting is Representative Petersburg. So we appreciate your help here today, Representative. Do you have testifiers who want to come forward and join you? Do you want to move your bill, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe House File 4103 to be moved, or excuse me, referred to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Very good. So thanks for helping out, and please proceed and describe the bill for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I am pinch hitting, as the Chair said, for Mr. Representative Daniels, who is under the weather today, and so I will do the best job that I can in doing that piece. And briefly, I will tell what the bill is and let the other testifiers talk for the pros and cons of this particular bill. Basically, for those of you that may not know, Faribault is home to the state academies for both the deaf and the blind in campus in eastern Faribault. And it is a little bit farther away from 35W, which is the main freeway that goes through town. And this bill just requests that more signage be put in place directing people to it for the various activities that they do, athletic events, etc. And with that, I'm going to turn over to the testifiers to give more detailed information.
Okay, very good. And who would like to begin the testimony? Okay, welcome, sir.
I will go ahead.
All right, and thank you for
Madam
being
Chair,
here.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Terry Wilding. I am the superintendent for the Minnesota State Academies. As he had just mentioned, I supervise two schools, one for the blind and one for the deaf, in the city of Faribault. This bill is proposed as we have a challenge in getting people to our campuses. We have signs on Highway 60 near our campuses, but they're very small highway that goes through town. Typically, when you drive to Faribault to see us, for example, as parents, Minnesota Department of Education, MMB, other agency people that want to come to us, they often cannot find our location because we are not clearly signed. There's not a clear sign from Highway 35 to leading them to the Highway 60 exit. So, statewide agency that we serve all over the state, most of our students drive through Faribault, usually on I-35. So we are requesting that a sign be placed. If you see on the map that we had handed out, there are three exits going into the city of Faribault. We are requesting to select one of those three. DOT can look at the traffic placement and see where it would be best placed so we could be located more easily. We are trying to envision becoming more visible throughout the state to serve more families who have children who are deaf or blind themselves, and we want to make those connections with the families throughout the state, and make us visible on 35 is an important part of that process. One more comment. In researching other states and schools for the blind and the deaf, those are mostly placed, they do have signs on the major highways directing them to where their schools are located. So we would like to parallel that same situation here in Minnesota, hoping that you will support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilding. And you know, is it possible to just get a question answered as to how many signs will be needed? Is it just two then that we're asking for, Representative Petersburg?
This is Mr. Wilding, yes, one in each direction.
Okay, all right, thank you. And I have Mr. Caddy, is that correct? Mr. Caddy is going to testify.
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair and representatives. Thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Alex Caddy. I am a board member of the Minnesota State Academies. Also, I'm an alumnus myself and the parent of three children, two of whom are deaf and one is hearing. My two deaf children do go to the State Academy for the deaf. And this school has been a wonderful resource for my children as well as for families with blind children. The School for Blind has been around for 152 years, and the School for the Deaf has been around for 155 years. So we would like our schools to be more visible so that each time people drive from Faribault to the Twin Cities area and vice versa, that they would see. We often see signs for Minnesota State University Mankato, other places like that, other state agencies and organizations. We would like to see that our agency as a state school is also visible by signage on the freeway. So I've contacted some friends from other states that do have signage on their local freeways leading them to the state academies, such as Texas School for the Deaf, Oklahoma School for the Deaf. These are all on the I-35 corridor. Also, the Minnesota State Association for the Deaf and our alumni associations do have support for this bill as well. They would like to see it on our 35 because they, on Interstate 35, because they feel it will have a great impact on our enrollment. So the state of Minnesota people can know where the resources are for deaf students and blind students. Thank you very much for your consideration and your time.
Thank you, Mr. Caddy. Appreciate your testimony, both of you gentlemen. And I believe there's a testifier from MnDOT, is that correct? All right. So welcome, and please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Josie Tays. I'm with the MnDOT Department of Transportation. So, as I said, we do have signs for them on Highway 60 that turns them onto the street that they get to the school. So generally, we usually allow a sign for the school that is the last trunk highway, the one closest to the school. They're asking for a sign on the I-35, which is our freeway. Freeways are our highest classification of roadway. They have the most people driving on them. They have, thus they're most in demand for signing. So the main purpose of signs is to inform motorists of regulations like speed limits, to warn them of curbs, and to guide them to their destinations through street signage and route markers. So that's our first priority when we get to signs on the interstate. After those needs are met, then we can go to supplemental signs. The supplemental signs that we allow on freeways are general motor services like gas, food, lodging, and then major traffic generators as well. When we sign for a traffic generator, we have to get you all the way to your destination. So we sign you on the freeway to know which exit to take. Then once you take your exit on the ramp, we have to tell you if you have to take a right or a left, and every turn you need to get to that destination. And the sign spacing is you have to be able to read a sign, comprehend the message, and take appropriate action for that sign. And that tells us how far away the signs have to be placed. So on I-35, if you go southbound I-35 and you go south, you have these ramps that are a loop. These ramps are already full of signs on there. They're already at their max spacing, and I believe there was a handout showing kind of just the signs we have on there, showing you the chevrons around the curve. You have a stop ahead sign. You have other logo signs as well. It's very full of signs already. So, and this is similar for both southbound exits to this facility. Another thing I wanted to point out with this bill is it doesn't say anything about payment, and payment for these types of signs, all requester signs for these will usually be paid for by the requesting agency as well.
Very good. Thanks for your testimony. Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, just a question for the testifier from MnDOT. Did you say if you were for or had concerns on this sign? I didn't hear that you said that.
So I have concerns on this sign because our standard is that we sign from the nearest trunk highway. So this is beyond the nearest trunk highway. The nearest trunk highway is Highway 60. This is from I-35. However, we acknowledge that because it doesn't meet our signing program, we have an appeal process. And so what they do is they would appeal anything that is just our policy. So if it's state statutes or engineering judgment for sign spacing, they cannot appeal that. But they can appeal it and go to the External Sign Variance Committee. They would hear their testimony about why they don't meet our cookie-cutter standards, and then they would hear from MnDOT as well as this is what our standard is, and then they would make a decision if they want to overrule MnDOT's decision or if they agree with our standards and denying the request. And then this decision from the External Sign Variance Committee goes up to our Commissioner of Transportation to make the final ruling on it.
Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. And then in this appeal process, who pays for that?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your last name.
Tatis,
Ms. Tatis.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So through all the requester pays, we call them requester pay signs because the requester is the one who pays for the sign. So every sign you see on the interstate from gas, food, lodging, stadium requests, other colleges, it's always the requesting agency that pays for these signs.
Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. And then typically, what is the average cost of an appeal process?
Ms. Tatis.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's no cost for the appeal process. They just asked us to set up the committee, go through the appeal. We asked the committee, and so the committee is made up of non-MnDOT people. It's usually non-engineers. It's usually local businessmen. I think we have some tourist agents, a tourist on there, AAA, and they come and they they testify in front of these people. So the appeal process doesn't cost anything. It's just if they give a sign, then they would have to pay for the sign itself.
Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And lastly, then, obviously, then, if we decide to put this in our omnibus bill and it passes, no appeal process is necessary. Is that correct?
Ms. Davis?
Madam Chair and Representative, that is correct.
Representative Yochim? Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering, maybe for MnDOT, is there, I'm trying to remember, there's been plenty of colleges off of trunk highways that also off of the main highways have signs as well, so more than just the immediate trunk highway. Is there different qualifications depending on what business or organization is being signed for? Or is it the same qualifications whether or not it's a business or a college or...
Ms. Fetus.
Madam Chair and Representative, there are different qualifications for different businesses, different facilities. So colleges, I know they have to have a certain attendance. They need about 400 students to apply to meet the criteria, as well as others. It also depends on what type of highway it is. So colleges get signs off of interstates, but if you go to like a high school, we don't allow them off of freeways. They only get them off of a smaller classification of road. So it does differ depending on what facility is asking.
Follow up, Representative? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would think that this school would be more equal to a college because it is a state agency school, and we only have two of those in the state, and that's Perfect Chen, the school for the blind and deaf. So I would hope that you would look at that qualification as a higher standard than a high school. I just wanted to throw that out there.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Liu.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name. From MnDOT. The test drives. Does that mean you've not yet gone through the appeals process?
Mr. Wilding?
This is Mr. Wilding. No. We were unaware of the appeals process. Representative Daniels, this was his idea. He introduced this bill. We are in support of it, so we were not aware of the MnDOT appeal process.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And
there's a new follow-up?
Yeah, just follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that the hope that this might impact enrollment. I'm just wondering, currently, where does student recruitment primarily take place? Are students referred to your school, or are these internet searches, or how currently do you recruit students?
Mr. Wilding?
Thank you for that question. We do many different things. We do have an internet search. We do community booths. We network. One of the most important ways is by people talking about us. Traditionally, our student numbers have decreased and we're becoming a little bit too isolated. We are in Faribault, but the outstate people are not aware of us. So this signage would be one small way that would bring more visibility to as we drive by on I-35, oh, there's a school for the blind. I have a family member or a friend or a neighbor who has a deaf or blind child. Maybe they weren't aware of us. So they're missing out on that learning opportunity to expand the visibility of our school.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So Representative Petersburg, well, are there others in the audience wishing to say something or comment? Don't see any. Representative Petersburg, any follow-up?
No, Madam Chair, I just thank you for your attention. Thank you for considering this, and I would like to renew my motion that House File 4103 be re-referred to Transportation Finance.
Very good. And we do know, I mean, there's maybe some other routes, but we will move the bill forward at this time. So all those in favor, we're referring House File 4103 to Transportation Finance. Signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was good.
And that's Representative fine. Kosnick, House File 3355.
Thank you.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
About your bill, but first of all, why don't you move it?
I would like to move House File 3355 to Transportation Finance, I believe.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So, Representative, please present your bill.
Okay. Members, this is the MnDOT agency provisions that they've asked us to take a look at, and so I'm happy to author it and present it to you. Probably for the sake of clarity, I will have Mr. Radin walk through some of those. And then I think there was two amendments, too. I don't know when you want to address those, Madam Chair.
Why don't we move those then right away? The A1, Representative Koznick, do you want to tell us what that does? Are these authors' amendments?
I could, but for the sake of clarity, I don't get anybody confused here. We'll let Mr. Radin do that one, but it's pretty simple.
Okay. Representative, Mr. Radin, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Radin, MnDOT Government Affairs. And the A1 is purely technical. The first two provisions to delete on or in two places were a request of an attorney at MnDOT. And then the changes on lines 1.4 through 1 through 6 of the amendment were actually suggested by Mr. Burris, just to clarify some language in the bill.
Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Nay, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay. And then the A2, is that an author's amendment?
Madam Chair, that is an author's amendment, and simply the bill was pre-drafted and deletes Section 9.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Bernardi?
Yes, Madam Chair. I am pulling out the bill to make sure that we're talking about the same thing, and this is to, you're not allowing the extension of the non-motorized transportation committee, and I think that is short-sighted. In the non-motorized transportation committee comes together around, obviously, non-motorized transportation things like bicycling and pedestrian work. And you know what? At some point in our travel, we're all pedestrians, and it's a huge issue. And for many years, our transportation department was a highway department, and it was about moving cars fast. Well, now we all know, and there's more to it than that, and making more about the mobility of people, of getting around, which includes whether they bike or walk or use transit or drive a car or those types of things. And this committee, what it does is it brings people from all over Minnesota to have a voice. So someone from every district is represented. And that's very important, because I'm a huge advocate of MnDOT hearing the voices of the public, and this committee allows that to happen. And Greater Minnesota especially is hit hard by not extending by not allowing this committee to continue forward. And what it means is it's like hurting the little person and saying, okay, let's say MnDOT would continue doing it and saying, but now we're not going to cover your costs for your travel or coming down to the metropolitan area. And so anyway, I believe it's short-sighted, and I did talk to Representative Koznick on it, and I am voting no and would hope that you would reconsider pulling your amendment.
Any questions? Further questions? Okay. All in favor? Did you wish to respond then, Representative Koznick?
Well, just briefly, Madam Chair. We talked about a little bit with the department before we came to the hearing, probably a couple of weeks ago, and the committee was set to sunset, so that's why we decided to leave that out of the bill at this point. So I would not be supporting. I'm going to support the amendment and letting the committee sunset.
Okay. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Koznick, I understand the position that you're put in. I would just like to echo Representative Bernardi's statements. This really, in the metro area, we have a lot of other nonprofit organizations that deal with a lot of the advocacy around this, but in Greater Minnesota, they don't. And they don't have the resources or the money to do it. So I think this really is not doing a service to citizens that are all over the state when it comes to finding safe ways to have pedestrians and bikeways and non-motorized vehicles. So I would hope you'd reconsider. Thank you.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you. I guess when we talked about it a little bit, the discussion came up that what would happen if it does sunset. And the fact is that MnDOT still has the ability to convene and gather input, and so that's why the amendment is being offered, that they still can continue to do that, and we're going to small attempt to kind of right-size government.
Representative Bernardi?
Madam Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
All right, roll call has been requested on the A2 amendment. I thought I saw it. Different sheets. Okay.
Chair Rimbeck?
Yes.
Representative Koznick?
Yes.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
Representative Barr C.
Yes.
Representative Barr R.
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Nope.
Representative Hurtas?
Yeah.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Cagle?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative McDonald?
Yes.
Representative New?
Yes.
Representative Petersburg?
Yes.
Representative Whalen?
Yes.
Representative West?
Yes.
Representative Yuki?
Nope.
On a vote of 10 ayes and 6 nays, the amendment prevails. So, thank you. All right, so Mr. Radin, do you want to take us through the bill then? I think it's some technical updates from your department.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Section 1 of the bill deals with condemnation commissioners, and so when the value of a parcel of land has to be determined by court during eminent domain, the court appoints individuals to assist in that process, and these individuals are referred to as condemnation commissioners. So Section 1 of the bill requires that these commissioners be residents of Minnesota, and we believe it's important to have knowledge of local real estate issues and state law, and so by requiring this, they will have that knowledge. And past practice has always been to have these commissioners be residents of Minnesota, but then there was a case recently where a judge decided that there was nothing in the statute specifically requiring them to be a resident of Minnesota, and so this just would allow us to continue past practice to have them be Minnesota residents. Section 2 of the bill eliminates a requirement that a judge in a condemnation case personally inquire about a commissioner's conflict of interest. The commissioners are required to sign an oath that includes the same requirements, but again, a court recently, the way they read the statute, decided that the commissioner had to personally appear in the courtroom, and that delayed the process by a few weeks. Section 3 of the bill allows a turnback of Highway 54, and turnbacks serve the public by assigning roads to the jurisdictions best able to effectively and efficiently operate them. And a trunk highway that's a low priority on the state system typically is given a higher priority once it becomes a county road or a city street. So this section again allows for the turnback of about almost 11 miles of Highway 54 to the county. Section 4 increases the limit on direct negotiation trunk highway contracts from $150,000 to $250,000. This was last raised in 1999 and has not kept pace with inflation. So this proposal shortens the contracting time for small projects, allowing MnDOT to be more responsive to urgent projects that are not part of the normal program, and also hopefully will help us increase the participation of small businesses, which are frequently owned by women, minorities, or veterans. Section 5 clarifies MnDOT's authority to implement an Indian employment preference on construction projects located on or near reservations. And this proposal addresses the underrepresentation of Indian employment on our construction projects. The Federal Highway Administration and Department of Human Rights set workforce participation goals, and so implementing this preference will assist MnDOT in achieving those goals. Section 6, the Federal FAST Act made several changes regarding vehicle length, and states are prohibited from enforcing limits less than what is in federal regulations. So this section modifies state law to provide specific length limits for automobile transporters, and it also allows them to transport cargo or general freight on backhauls. In Section 7, the FAST Act created a weight exemption for logging vehicles on a small portion of Interstate 35 near Duluth. And this section of the bill clarifies that logging vehicles can haul loads over 80,000 pounds on the portion of Interstate 35 that Congress designated in federal law. Section 8 amends language that was enacted last year, providing that size, weight, and load limits do not apply to emergency vehicles. And again, the Federal FAST Act included a change regarding emergency vehicles and established various weight limits. So this proposal clarifies that emergency vehicles operating only on interstates in Minnesota are subject to those limits in federal law. Section 9 of the bill was deleted. Section 10 grants MnDOT discretion to waive payment and performance bonds on direct negotiation contracts. The ability to obtain these bonds can be a barrier preventing small businesses from competing on MnDOT projects. So this change will allow more businesses to compete on our projects, benefiting minority-owned, women-owned, and veteran-owned businesses. And we would envision granting this waiver only on about 10 to 12 projects per year. So it would by no means be all projects, but just a small number of projects. Sections 11 through 17 are additional trunk highway turnbacks. You can see them listed there. The Highway 222 turnback in Red Lake County is about 1.5 miles. Highway 253 in Faribault County is about 6.4 miles. Highway 254 in Faribault County is about 4.5 miles. Highway 277 in Chippewa County is about 11 miles. And then the three in the city of Faribault altogether are a total of about 2.1 miles. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Medin. Any other other folks that wish to testify from the audience? Any other questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, then I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3355 as amended to Transportation Finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. And with that, I believe we are adjourned, and we will see you on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Oh.